Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tracy Kidder has been described by the Baltimore Sun as the master of the nonfiction narrative. In his beautiful book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and I'm sure many of you have read it, he told the true story of Dr. Paul Farmer, a gifted man in love with the world who set out to do all he could to cure it. Farmer is, in Kidder's words, the least ordinary person. In Kidder's new book, Strengthen What Remains, he offers another hero for our time, Deo Gratias, or Deo, a refugee from Burundi who arrives in an American big city with $200 in his pocket, almost no English, and, as Kidder writes, a horror so fresh that he sometimes confuses present, past and present. 2 years later, Deo enrolls in an Ivy League university, and Kidder asks himself, how did this happen? Spinning that question into a stunning narrative that becomes as powerful and compelling as those journeys of myth. Tracy Kidder has won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Award, among other prizes, and in addition to Mountains Beyond Mountains, he's the author of My Detachment, Hometown, Old Friends, Among School Children, House, and The Soul of a New Machine. And joining him on stage after he gives a brief presentation, we have Tom Kerwin, staff writer and editor for the Los Angeles Times. And as anyone who's been reading the Los Angeles Times knows, Tom is another master of nonfiction narrative. In the past year, he's written memorable and lyrical explorations of a disfigured teenager and her surgical and emotional transformation, the recording of wild sound, the implications of the illegal trade in exotic animals. He was the editor of the outdoors section, the late lamented outdoors section, a writer for the features section, and a deputy editor of the book review. He's been honored. He has many honors, and his work has been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And he is a big reason I subscribe to the Los Angeles Times, and I hope you do as well. Right now, please welcome Tracy Kidder to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Nice to be here. I'm going to speak quickly. A young medical student named Deo Gratias narrowly survives the onset of civil war in his native country, the small East Central African nation of Burundi. He survives because he left the door to his room open and the men who would have killed him assumed he'd already fled. He made a 6-month-long escape, first from Burundi's civil war, then from the genocide in Rwanda, and then back to Burundi. And then almost by accident, he got transported to New York City. Whoops. I think I just did something terrible. He arrived at JFK in New York, as Leslie said, with $200 in his pocket, no English, no friends or relations, and terrible memories. His first trip on a subway got lost for most of a day. He eked out a sort of living delivering groceries. At night, he slept in Central Park. And then one day, sick and near despair, he was delivering groceries to a little church on the Upper East Side, and he met an ex-contemplative nun who decided that what he needed was a family and set out to find him one, and succeeded. He was essentially adopted by a childless American couple, a painter and a sociologist, neither young nor rich, but big-hearted and brave, obviously. And less than 2 years after landing in New York, he was enrolled at Columbia University. I was struck by this story the first time I heard it from Deo, struck by its various remarkable features, by its drama. But what drew me to it, first of all, what made me think I might like to try to write about this was something rather small. Recounting his time of homelessness, Deo mentioned that before heading for bed in Central Park, he'd look all around him to make sure that no strangers were watching, because anyone who saw him entering the park at that hour would know that he was homeless. When he told me this, I thought of my daughter. As a young teenager visiting New York, she started to cross a busy street against the light, and my wife yelled at her. And afterward, in cold fury, my daughter said, "Thanks a lot, Mom, for ruining my reputation in New York City." I knew this story of Deo's was true, and more than that, I recognized his feelings, and not just in my daughter. I can imagine myself in his place, fearing the eyes of strangers, fearing not the darkness of the park, not what might happen to me if I surrendered myself to sleep there, but the disdain or pity of strangers, who would always be strangers. And feeling this, I thought I could find a way into his story if he decided he was willing to let me tell it, as he eventually was. The other day, someone told me I'm a purposive writer. And by purposive, I think she meant writing that aims to expose and analyze important problems and to offer persuasive solutions. But somehow it seems important to say that I don't deserve that compliment. Some writers do. Writers who understand that the world's recurring catastrophes, the inequitable distribution of health, war and genocide, aren't accidents but the products of socioeconomic and political structures with histories that can be unearthed. These writers focus their books on large groups of people. They make pause now and then to describe individuals, but as a rule they do this to illustrate points they want to make about something they feel is more important, which is the fates of populations. I respect the motives that often lie behind this kind of writing. I've learned from people who write theoretically. I'm forever in their debt, but I have a hard time bending my mind around generalizations. All I can think of are the exceptions. To me, the sheer scale of big subjects, subjects like genocide and war and epidemic disease, makes them incomprehensible through one approach alone. I don't think you could understand the Great Depression just by reading The Grapes of Wrath, but I don't think you could take in the enormity of the Holocaust without reading at least one account of an individual life enmeshed in the Holocaust in, say, Primo Levi's great novel, The Periodic Table. By training, all the Dickens my mother used to read me, by inclination, by deficiency, I think, I understand the world best through stories. And because the engine of any story is human character, I've spent most of my life as a writer looking not for subjects but for characters. A small-town cop whom I met because I was speeding. My wife met him the same day for the same reason later, and he didn't give her a ticket. It turned out, this is one of the things that interested me about him, that, it was that he never gave women tickets, or almost never did, because he hated to see women cry. There were a pair of old men in a nursing home who were spending their last days doing something more interesting and more difficult than playing bingo, which was making friends. A team of computer engineers who were trying to build a new machine, essentially against their company's wishes. On one occasion, I set out to find a person in a profession, but once I found her, a school teacher in a grubby elementary school in a rundown Massachusetts mill town, what I set out to do was to tell the story of a year in the life of her classroom. And if that story happened to reveal some general truths about the problems of public education in America, so much the better, I felt. But I couldn't have generalized her, not with her and her class so vividly in front of me. I once wrote a book about the building of a house, an idea I got from having been my own carpenter for a while, my own terrible carpenter for a while. What fascinated me once I got into that project were the carpenters and the homeowners and the architect and the relations among them, a menage a trois without sexual connotations. And Mountains Beyond Mountains, my book about Paul Farmer, really began when I ran into Paul by accident in Haiti, and Strength in What Remains began in much the same way when I met Deo on a visit to Paul Farmer. And in both cases, I was interested initially not in the issues that interested those men, but in the outlines of their lives, which seemed eminently suited to storytelling. The truth is that what I aspire to is art. Art has the great power to transform the experience of suffering and injustice into something beautiful. And I think, I'm really quoting others, that art's created with a certain obliviousness to both to commerce and to didacticism. The great storyteller Jorge Luis Borges once said that if you're writing a story about time, the one word forbidden you is the word time. When you've written a book and you're often asked what it's about, it's quite a legitimate question. I have a little trouble doing that, particularly with this new book. Certainly it has to do with war and genocide and with courage and endurance and the generosity of strangers, the uses of disuses and disuses of memory. But we already know the basic truths about those subjects, that war and genocide are deplorable, that human beings are capable of great resilience, that charity happens, that for human beings, memory can be an ungovernable torment. What I wanted, without ever telling myself this, was to allow readers to experience those facts not as truisms, but as we experience them in our lives, to experience them as again through Deo. This is what good writers do. They make the world new again. I think that the storyteller's central job is to catch the reflection of individual human beings on the page. But the richest factual narratives always have something in addition. If you're drawn, first of all, to individual characters, you're also drawn, of course, to try to understand the worlds that they inhabit, especially the subjects that preoccupy them. And in Deo's case, the main subjects were in our public health and medicine and the ravaged state of his native country after 13 years of civil war. His story has an ending that even now amazes me. When I first began following him around, Deo had permanent residency and was soon to become an American citizen. He didn't have to go back to Burundi, where public health is all but non-existent and where even now hospitalized patients who can't pay their bills are detained, imprisoned essentially, without food or care. But mainly because of those facts, Deo returned continually and amid the post-war wreckage, with the help of his legions of American and Burundian friends and family, he created an organization called Village Healthworks, which has built a clinic and public health system free to those who can't pay in a rural village. This isn't an easy thing to do in a desperately poor country. This clinic was a pile of rocks when I first visited the site with Deo in the summer of 2006. But by the fall of 2008, it was a growing public health system that was providing food to the hungriest people in the area and clean water to all of them. It was also a medical center which in its first year and a half of operation treated 28,000 different patients, most of them for free. There was and there still is nothing like this operation elsewhere in Burundi. People come there for help from all over the country, and they come from other countries too, from Congo and Tanzania. And some visitors have come not to not for medical help, but just to see the place. When Deo asked one of these travelers why he'd come, the man said, to see America. In his speech from Ghana, perhaps you remember Obama, President Obama imagined this partnership between the United States and Africa, one grounded in mutual responsibility. It seems to me Village Healthworks is one small example of that, a model of African and American cooperation. Obama's vision embodied in miniature, an instrument of peace. Burundi is a country that was ripped apart largely by artificial differences between two groups of people, differences exaggerated for the advantage of a few. Deo has inspired an antidote, or the beginning of a possible antidote, which focuses on something that unites all of us, our common vulnerability to illness and injury, our common hope for life. Personally, I find this very moving. Especially this clinic because it enjoys such extraordinary support from its community, especially from the women of the village who have a large say in its operations. And I thought I'd finish my quick talk here by reading you a short passage from near the end of Strength and What Remains. Speaking at a fundraiser in New York, Deo told this story. This past summer, we needed some help to make a road that goes to our site passable. A friend of mine told me, "Well, Dale, there's a great Belgian construction company that builds roads in Burundi and Rwanda and the Congo," and I was so excited. So I went to talk to the representative of the company. He sent someone to look at the road and estimated a cost of at least $50,000, not to pave the road, but just to widen it and make it passable. I went back frustrated, wondering how to tell the Kagutu community this bad news. As I was explaining this to them, one woman with a baby crying on her back said to me, "You will not pay a penny for this road. We become so much sick because we are poor, but we are not poor because we are lazy. We will work on this road with our own hands." Excuse me. The next day, 166 people showed up with pickaxes, hoes, machetes, and other tools. One of the volunteers was a woman who came to work with a sick child. When a friend of mine and I looked at the baby, we saw that the baby was sweating. I then asked the mother why she came to work with a child that sick, and she said to me, "Well, I've already lost 3 children, and I know this one is next, whether I stay at home or come to work here. So it's better for me to join others and make my contribution, which will help to save someone else's child who will be sick but alive when you have a clinic in Kagutu." The entire road, 6 kilometers long, was rebuilt by these people with machetes and hoes. The same day the road was finished, the representative of the Belgian Road Construction Company called me to negotiate the price. You can imagine how I felt to get that call from him. I said to him, "Thank you so much for your call, but it's already done." He was obviously shocked and said to me, "What do you mean? Who did it? We are the only road construction company in the entire region." And I said, "Not anymore." I'm going to show you just one picture from this. This is a boy brought to the clinic who had been abandoned. He's clearly malnourished. That's the Burundian doctor on site, the doctor in charge. Malnourished. And I just wanted to show you this. They fed him. It's really simple. So I think Tom and I are going to talk now, right? Yeah, thank you. I'm going to have some water. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. Is this thing getting some recording levels off of this thing, I hope? What a pleasure to be up here with Tracy. I've been reading his books for many years and admiring his storytelling, his prose, his ability to take a story and put it together in a way that it just sort of sneaks up on you. His writing is transparent. His intelligence is always guiding every word and every passage and every bit of the prose altogether in the narrative. It's really a delight, and one of the reasons why I aspire towards narrative writing in my own work and what I try to do. Strengthen What Remains is a book that catches up on you. You find yourself reading it, and you find yourself suddenly remembering it, more importantly. And I guess what I'd like to start the conversation with, since Tracy and Louise put together a pretty good sketch of what the book is about and the trajectory that Tracy follows in telling the story, I'd like to talk about the character of Deo a little bit. He's really a remarkable man, young man, and to the character that he evolves to at the end. And I had to think that there's a certain part in which I'm reading this and I'm seeing this the image of this man in New York City at first who seems almost naive, seems very sensitive, almost porous to the world around him. And I guess what I was wondering, when you first met him, well, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your evolving relationship with him and what you saw in his character as that relationship with him deepened.
Well, gee.
There's a lot there, I know.
Well, I met him, but I didn't really get to know him. My wife, I met him when I went to visit Paul Farmer, and my wife had come, and I talked to Paul, and she talked to Deo, essentially, and then she told me the story that Deo had told her, what she remembered of it on the drive home. And I was struck by it. And I went to see him. He seemed, several years later I went to see him. I think he strikes almost everyone. You're struck by his warmth and his openness, apparent openness. I think... in his friendliness, there's an ineffable quality, about a lot of human beings, but he has something. in addition, I can't quite, it's a terrible thing for a writer to say, you can't quite describe something, but I do remember that though I felt I was getting to know him pretty well, I suddenly, when I traveled with him to Burundi, and we got off the plane, and suddenly he was in charge. I wrote this, that he seemed a size larger, maybe really two sizes larger. All of a sudden, I saw him in a different way altogether.
It's interesting when you read about his life in New York City. I'm reading this, and it's almost remarkable given how open he is to the world, how sort of pushed from one side to another by his experiences in the city. It's hard to imagine that it's hard to cast him at first as a survivor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that deep down he's a cautious person from experience, and he does come from a culture that seems to value silence, but he's kind of an effervescent, a fairly emotional person, as like his mother, as he himself put it. It is true that what I find remarkable is he's not cynical, he's not a despairing person, and I would have expected all of those things. I mean, he carries a heavy burden of memories, memories that we can scarcely imagine. I mean, at least I can. But he's handled them awfully well, I must say. We were going to talk about that, so
I guess, well, that's, as I say, he comes across in New York. I mean, the difference between his character in New York and his character when he gets back home is, as you say, it's almost day for night. He grows so much larger through your eyes when he gets off the plane in Burundi. What I found was interesting in New York is how that city seemed to trigger so many memories. Granted, it was very fresh in his mind, of his experience in the Civil War and in the genocide. As if that city that city presented its own challenges to him, almost on a par in some manner as the experiences back home.
What he said was, "No one was chasing me with a machete now, and now it was my mind's turn to run." On the other hand, he did get robbed once in one of the abandoned tenements where he was staying, but he didn't feel in physical danger so much as in psychological, I think, danger. Although he wasn't treated very well, had a horrible job, and wasn't treated well in that job. I think the thing that was hardest for him, judging from the account of that he gave me, was being a man and a pretty accomplished person. I mean, to have gotten where he had gotten in Burundi, he had to work like a demon, and you had to be pretty smart to get to medical school at all. And he was at the top of his class. But suddenly to need to feel like a child, to need almost everything. And I can understand that.
His inability to take tips.
At first, his inability to take tips, yes.
And the difficulty he had when he met with that Catholic worker, Sharon.
Yeah.
And sort of that, sort of a love-hate relationship that he had with her.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't, yes, that's right. Not really.
That's casting.
Love-hate. I think he would get really quite annoyed and irritated with her, but he kept coming back. And of course, she's one of the important people in his life now.
I think you describe it that he felt like a cat following his mother when he would be with Sharon going through the city, which sort of plays up that sort of sense of his pride and the sort of sense that he had to sort of swallow his pride to some extent to be able to accept the kindness of these individuals.
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, I don't think that's not as hard for me to imagine as some other things, that he went through. But yeah.
Yeah, and I guess back to New York. I mean, I think there's a stunning moment where he's just sort of standing there watching traffic, and he's just wishing. He's wondering when his life is going to come to an end. He's wishing. He's almost wishing that it would come to an end.
Yeah.
Because at that point, everything is.
Well, that's what he told me. Maybe I should just walk out into traffic. But he was feeling really bad, sick. Physically, I think just really bad diet, and it was right at the moment when, at least in his memories, when he felt near despair, that he met Sharon.
Yeah. So it's one of the really moving parts of this book are his interactions with these strangers. The kindness of strangers, the phrase that easily comes to mind when you see people reaching out for him. One of the more wonderful sort of and poignant sort of moments is when he's crossing the border from Burundi into Rwanda. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? That's
sure,
a great sequence.
Well, he had been escaping for a better part of a week. He has no way of knowing how many days, but he was exhausted and he fell asleep in a banana grove and awakened to see refugees passing through the banana grove. These would have been, you know, I said, you have this thing, ethnicity in these countries. It's really hard to understand. But anyway, he was terrified of her. What was happening actually was that a huge part of the Hutu population of Burundi was fleeing the certain retaliation of the Tutsi army. We don't want to get into all this. This is too complicated. But the woman approached him, and he was terrified of her. And she said to him, you know, don't be afraid of me. Essentially, don't be afraid of me. You think I'm a Hutu, and that's true, but I am a woman and a mother first. That's my Oboko, my ethnicity. I bet you most Burundians feel that way these days. I mean, I'm sure there are still some entrepreneurs of ethnic hatred out there, but, you know, after 13 years of civil war, I think, you know, the real problem in that country is poverty and all the things that come with it. But anyway, I mean, and I, you know, it's murder and mayhem do not define Burundi. It's only 3% of young men joined armed movements during the war, for instance. Mm-hmm. Most of the civilian population was, as usual, caught in the crossfire. Right. Anyway, he had luck. He did meet some people who helped him. And then when he got to New York, there was that baggage handler from Senegal who spoke French and helped him through immigration. So he was lucky along the way.
You know, you often read these stories and you just look at the kindness and you wonder what are the degrees of luck? What is it that makes luck happen to some people and such bad fortune fall upon others? It's sort of one of those, as you say, those sort of ineffable questions as you think about this. One of the things that I found so interesting in the book, and perhaps this is comes from your association and Deo's association with Paul Farmer, is this really sort of wonderfully eye-opening and complicated notion of how poverty works itself into the health of individuals,
yeah,
and how poverty leads to sort of notions of genocide, how profound self-hatred can lead to medical and health abuses, as well as
violence.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say that the genocide in Rwanda, the civil war in Burundi, were caused directly by poverty. It was more complicated than that. But to ignore that as the essential setting of these slaughters would be a great mistake, it seems to me. But certainly, the connection between poverty and ill health is, is undeniable and obvious in many, many parts of the world. It's not really hard to understand or explain. I mean, one way to explain it is to just turn it around and say, well, if you clean up water supplies in a place like Kagutu, you'll see infant mortality drop like a stone. It's a tremendously powerful thing to do, but then you have to say, well, how poor do you have to be as a nation, as a village, not to have potable water? Right. And a lot of places in the world don't have it.
Right. And I guess I'm also struck, he had a high school teacher who talked to him a little bit about it. There was a line that in which the high school teacher says, you know, there are so many ways in which poverty finds its ways into the bodies of the destitute.
Yeah, this was a man named Bishop Ududira, a really great figure in Burundi. He died young. I think he died of natural causes. But he was one of these peacemakers who wanted to quell this ethnic idiocy.
And how do you parse that statement? So many ways in which poverty finds its way into the bodies of the destitute.
Well, if you're too poor to have clean water, you're going to end up with worms. You know, you're going to end up with intestinal parasites. Malnutrition is a great aider and abettor of tuberculosis. I think it's really well established in the literature. Just
and there's another way of thinking of it too, isn't there? About how the association between poverty and self-esteem. I mean, I think that was perhaps one of Deo's problems in New York City, was that sense of feeling worthlessness. If Sharon, this person that was trying to find him a place to stay in the city, kept trying and knocked on so many doors, and it was so difficult at first to get him a place to stay in the city. And Deo's reaction to that was sort of a feeling of worthlessness.
Right. And he was very struck when he read W.E.B. Du Bois's book, you know, is it The Souls of Black Folk?
Right. Yeah.
The famous lines in which Du Bois says that to be poor in any country is hard, but to be a poor man in a land of dollars is the hardest thing of all. And Deo had that vividly in front of him. He was, after all, delivering groceries in the Upper East Side, right. among some of the priciest real estate in the world, and passing by the shops where he'd look in and see a child's jacket, saying, I can't even buy a button. And he said, how can you don't feel human? Because how could you be a human being like everybody else here if you were this different? And when he had gone through that, when he found the book, when he discovered Du Bois in Columbia, it made tremendous sense to him. I think there's probably something more to say about this, but I can't think of it at the
moment. And I guess that's the thing. As a reader, that's where I made the leap in reading this story, is how this man who feels in New York City his own worthlessness and draws an association between that and poverty and homelessness, and taking that and drawing it out and trying to understand what went on back in Rwanda and Burundi, is that sense of people who are so poor and correct me on this if this isn't a quite right interpretation, but are so poor that they feel almost like they don't deserve anything better than the terrible fate that befell them.
I don't know if that's true. Honestly, I don't know enough to know that, but I suspect that I suspect it isn't, certainly across the board. I think about that woman, about the people coming out to work on the road, about their ardent desire of those people for a clinic, which makes perfect sense. Or, something that I ran into in Haiti, or that really Paul Farmer ran into in Haiti, among people who had been kept illiterate for, forever, mm-hmm. their ancestors, and they had been kept illiterate. The main thing that the people in the village where Paul Farmer first started working wanted was a hospital and schools. So I think people who are desperately poor are often very perceptive about the reasons why they're poor. It's hard to generalize, though.
No, of course, and that's the value, as you said in your opening comments, about working with the specificity as you do in this story, is it allows you not to make the generalizations that a reader, as I interpret it, and I feel sort of the weight of colonization and all the sort of catchphrases of 20th century geopolitics as we try to understand how the unimaginable could have taken place there. An interesting part, what I found as a writer in reading this book is how Tracy has chosen to tell this story. The first half of the book, or the first third roughly, is a really wonderful sort of pure narrative, which is Deo's story. And as a reader, as you and I were talking before we stepped out on the stage here, as a reader, I was reading this opening, wondering, how did you get this information? Where did this language come from? Where obviously it was reported and obviously gathered from Deo, but you weren't a part of that narrative. Mm-hmm. Then you get to part two of the story, and suddenly you are a character. You are the reporter. You do step on front of the stage as well, and join Deo in telling the story. Can you talk about the decision to follow that course of narrative?
It's just I write by trial and error. I write. The hardest part of writing for me is writing a rough draft, and I write at great length, and I don't turn away from any possibilities. It's a huge mess, usually, by the time I'm done. And I write it as fast as I can, as I often think of it as writing as fast as I can to prevent remorse for having written badly. And then I rewrite. And I love rewriting, actually. But I try different things. And I was having some problems with this, bringing certain things I felt to life in this story. And part of what I wanted to do, I knew somewhere in here I wanted to acknowledge to the reader that, the story of this escape, and some of New York, although I was able to verify a lot of things, it was based on memories that are 12 years old. So, of course, they can't be perfectly accurate. I tried to be true to what I, the stuff I heard learned from Dale, but I just wanted to make that acknowledgement. But I think it was more that I, somewhere along the line hit on this. It just seemed like writing about Sister Sharon, for instance. She's not actually technically a sister anymore, but it worked better if I wrote about her with the first person there for some. It was as though I didn't want to tromp all over Deo's narrative, having the first person there. But I needed that presence somehow to write about these other people. And I also, I think I write in order to think. I mean, that's how I think, to the extent that I think at all. And I felt that, I went back. I guess once the structure suggested itself to me, and I'm not quite sure where it came from, although I worked very closely with an editor who was working with me on it. Once we sort of hit on the structure, it seemed to me to make a certain kind of sense to first, here's the memory, here's the basic story, here are the memories, and then in the second part we see him in the throes of those memories. And we see, largely through my eyes, the recovery. I mean, I don't know.
I think that's what's so interesting is the effect, is sort of the aesthetic effect as a reader of experiencing this book, and that first half is that sort of pure experience. It's that transparent pane of glass as you're looking at Deo on the streets of New York and you're reading descriptions that had to have come from his language when he describes his school as being what, like 2 descents away, or when he got malaria, he has this wonderful description of it, like the wind.
The wind hurt, your skin, it's like you're flayed.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just really gripping language that comes from Deo himself that you captured, no doubt, in your conversations with him. But you don't discover these conversations until this later in the book itself. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, because in your capturing of your conversations with him, as a reader, I'm getting the impression that you were sort of walking along thin ice to some extent. I mean, wondering how many of these memories do you open up? Mm-hmm. There's an incident where you perhaps you can explain this better than I can, about when you evoke his grandfather who had been dead, and you sort of caught yourself as understanding that maybe was not the right thing at the right time.
We were I can be pretty obtuse. We were in Central Park. He was just showing me the places where he'd slept, and he was in pretty good mood, and he said, it was so much nicer being in the park than in these abandoned tenements in Harlem. He said to be outdoors again. He was a country boy. He grew up, of farming, herding cows. And when he said that, he said, but, to be with nature again. He said, but then there were all these memories that came back. And I said, of your grandfather. And he said, yeah. And then I said, you didn't know he was dead, but you must have assumed that he was. And he was gone for a while for me, it was as though he was right back in that moment. And he started saying that he didn't feel well. And, I don't feel great about this. Perhaps if I had foreseen how difficult some of this would be for him, I might never have done it. It was of course, difficult for him to go back to these stations of his life in New York, but particularly in Burundi and Rwanda. And, you know, I sometimes felt as though the memories of what had happened there were almost like little living creatures, bacilli or something, that were waiting there in the landscape for him to return. So I owe him an apology. I did apologize at one point. anyway.
How as a writer do you maintain the sort of strength to continue?
Whatever strength was required was on his side, I think. It's not a comfortable feeling to feel you're inflicting something on someone else. It's,
of course.
But it's much harder to be the one that's having something inflicted on you. I think it's always worth remembering that. He was very, he's very good to me. Once he had agreed to let me do this, he kept his side of the bargain.
Did you ever have, after you say, after you asked about the grandfather or made that statement, you say he got sick, and I remember you're right, he has ulcers or stomach ache at that particular time, I mean, was there ever a point where you thought that maybe the cost of his remembering is too great for the purpose of the book?
Well, there was a time, I think twice, I have notes on it somewhere, that I offered to stop, and he didn't take me up on...
What was going through your mind when you offered to stop?
Just what you said. I thought maybe this is too much, But at a certain point, if you're writing a story, you're working on a story, you've put a year into it. You've got to say, look, I'll stop now, but I can't stop if you don't stop me now, because
I understand that. That's why I'm asking. A couple of my stories have been the same way, where you think to yourself, this is too difficult for the person I'm talking to.
That's why I'd like to write fiction. The only problem is that if you write fiction, then everyone assumes you're writing about them. in your family, anyway.
Have you written fiction?
I have written some.
And?
The sum total of is... except for this dreadful novel I wrote when I got back from Vietnam, which was all about experiences I didn't have in Vietnam, I've written three short stories that are all published. But I mean, that's it.
What is your experience? I love nonfiction, and I certainly enjoy the process of reporting stories and crafting it. It seems like fiction writers, there are just far too many choices with fiction.
Yeah. I think you're right. Too much freedom.
Exactly.
I remember vividly when I was a young man, an older writer, a guy who really befriended me, saying that if he were a young man, he'd go out and get a job with Time or Newsweek because the world was so interesting. And it was so hard to compete with the strangeness and wildness of the world as a novelist. It stuck with me. And, around that time, stories weren't coming to me. So I did go out and start stealing people's shadows.
Say that again.
I went out and started stealing people's shadows.
Stealing people's shadows.
Yeah.
That's a great line.
I don't know where it came from, but
yeah, it has a sort of a double edge to it. A certain degree of maybe. Guilt's probably too strong a word, but the word stealing is awfully strong.
Right. I don't know. I think it's a... I suppose that everything is problematic. I wouldn't... This is the way I write. This is what I love to do. And I suppose I could always be a little better at making sure the people I'm writing about really are... want this done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they don't always know ahead of time.
Right. I guess that stealing people's shadows made me sort of... I mean, when I finished this book, I after seeing what Deo's managed to do with his life, I think to myself, I've just totally wasted my life. I mean, this is an extraordinary individual. As a writer, do you ever sort of begin to wonder the efficacy of writing itself and want to start your own clinic instead?
Well, there. I think it's pretty hard to be in a place like Kagutu and not wish that you were a doctor, for instance, that you could do something direct and quickly. But I don't have any of those skills. I have raised a daughter who does. but I have none myself. Yeah, she's my proxy for that. But I do feel as though, you know, when you see the kind of unnecessary and unjust suffering that exists in places like Burundi and Kagutu, and less of it now in Kagutu, I must say, or in Haiti, or, you know, all the places where Partners in Health works. And I think most of us would just tend to feel that we've incurred some kind of responsibility for at least trying to do something about it. And so it isn't that I write in order to try to correct these things. That would be a fool's errand anyway, I think. But I do feel like it's important to have this other part of this. I mean, if I'm not saying this very well, but I would like to, you know, to try to help those organizations that I believe in.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. Is it sort of a question that I've been having in my life as I look at writing and try to think about the efficacy of writing in a world in which people aren't reading books anymore, let alone newspapers? Clearly, your writing opens up minds and consciousnesses in a wonderful and effective way. But I look at writers, for instance, and I think, for instance, the name that comes to mind is Bill McKibben, and I look at his, what's his organization, 360, in which he's trying to do so much about climate change and stuff. And I look at him, and I think to myself, is this someone who has felt that writing is good up to a certain point, but the problems of the world have gotten so acute and so desperate at this point in our history that suddenly, you know, damn it, I just can't be writing anymore. I really do need to start taking action in a much more vigorous manner.
Well, I can't speak for Bill, but yeah, obviously, but you know, I think you can do both. It's not true that nobody's reading books, but it is true that not enough people are.
Not enough people are. Thank you.
but I mean, I don't see any inherent conflict between having, you know, an interest in trying to help, say, Village Health Works, and writing this book in as honest a way as I could. I mean, I don't see why Bill can't keep writing and also have his organization.
I think I probably reveal a little bit more about myself in that question.
Well, I understand, though.
What I'm struck too is sort of the courage of the reporting of this book. I mean, you frown because...
I frown because I'm really
courageous.
Feel that way. I don't feel like it required much courage.
Why don't you tell the story? The name of the village was Mutaho, you say?
Mutaho, yeah.
Mutaho. Can you tell the story about what that was like for you, to go into that village with Deo?
Well, this was the place where his travail had begun. It was the remnant of the hospital where he had just narrowly escaped being killed, and it was still there. In fact, most of the hospital had been knocked down, but the part that he had lived in, the room that he had occupied, was still there. And in fact, the building had been fixed up on the outside. Inside, it was a horror. And I remember after the whole thing, he said, I don't know if you noticed, I was a different person there. It would have been hard not to notice. I mean, he really went, he was angry. I'd never seen him so angry. And it was came out in a. I should say first of all, I don't think we were ever in any physical danger, but the whole lead up to this was so. I think, in fact, this whole story displays the lack of courage that I have. I found myself. I mean, the excuse I have is I was trying to understand how he was feeling, and he was feeling pretty, you know, angry, and he was sort of back there, and I felt as though I was inside a dream of his, and we were going through this place with the supposed doctor in charge. The place was horrible inside. It was completely moribund. Nobody was using it. There were just a few rusty bed frames in there, and in a you know, it had been fixed up to make it look like, you know, nothing had ever happened there, I guess. That was part of what made him so angry. And also to have spent those resources to do that in a country where so many people are dying of, you know, easily preventable diseases just seemed in itself offensive. But I just felt like I was inside a nightmare of Deo's, and and was looking at the source of that nightmare simultaneously. It was a very odd feeling, and I wanted to get out of there in the worst way. And eventually we did, and then he was going to go on to another town that had been along his trip, and I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to get out of there, and out of the whole region. And I got, as I said, I'm afraid I got a little vehement. Yeah. Oh, let's go.
But the fact that you went there in the first place is the, what I target as being the courage, the decision to go there and to continue with the reporting and to actually, you know, embark upon a story like this in a country that is rather precarious in certain aspects, particularly in that quadrant of the country.
I just, I think if it was scary for me, it was much scarier for him. And as I said, I really don't think we were in any physical danger. And I know of writers who have taken much bigger risks. I don't know. It didn't feel like. In fact, sure. I felt sort of craven, to tell you the truth.
On that particular trip, you pass a village in which there is in Burundi like one of the few memorials to the civil war and to the genocide.
Yeah.
Describe that.
It looks sort of like a Greek temple. It's small. It was clearly neglected. It was erected out near a school where during the civil war a bunch of students had been slaughtered. But Burundi doesn't have very many memorial sites.
And the language on that memorial?
Plus jamais. My French is horrendous. Plus jamais ça. Never again.
Never again.
French for never again. And, you know, never again is, so far, I'm afraid, an empty platitude. Often self-enhancing. I mean, how could it not be? Think of it. Think of what's going on right now. Actually, on that general subject, I almost wish we could get rid of the word genocide, because it somehow makes a distinction between killing hundreds of thousands of people who are just like you and killing hundreds of thousands of people who aren't. I don't know in the end that it matters. I mean, both to me are equally horrible. But it does seem to me that we need memorials. We need to remember these things.
And contrast that never again. I mean, you and Deo similarly sort of found that phrase and that memorial, that phrase wanting, and that memorial I won't put words in your mouth. Better to ask you instead to characterize the memorial that you saw in Rwanda.
Well, we saw a lot of them, but the one that I wrote most about was in a place called Murambi, where something on the order of 50,000 people were killed. In a very short period of time. But this, as I wrote, was really a museum now. I mean, it's true, it was graphic, stark, but it was orderly. And you could feel, it was an intentional place, and you could feel that reason, human reason, was putting up a stand against, the forces of violence and chaos. Whereas in Mutaho, it felt like a place of unfinished business, and even though there were no bones there, I think it was a big difference.
It's a stunning distinction in the book, as you describe it, and it really sort of captures what is, I think, a subtext of this book is just the difficulty of remembering and the problems with remembering and almost the virtue of forgetfulness. You almost get the impression that remembering is a construct that people who have not suffered want to put upon the world.
Well, I sometimes feel that way, and I feel that same way about the word forgiveness, which unfortunately is on the cover of this book, but won't be forever.
You want to tell that?
You should perhaps
explain that then.
No, well, there's always this argument as to whether there should be a subtitle, and booksellers like them. I understand. I acceded to this. It's my fault, but I did ask the other day if in future printings if they could be taken off. But in a more serious vein, forgiveness is a word that we also use in the same way as though it were something that all the injured people owed to people who had injured them. You know,
right.
Whereas, of course, it has to be an act of free will. I'm not for a moment suggesting that it isn't an important thing. I mean, an advisable thing for many people to do. And it's one of the striking things about Dale that, you know, after, in spite of all that he had been through, he did not divide the world in the Manichaean way, good and evil, got black and white and good and evil. He, as I said, you know, he refuses to do that, and he has not allowed himself to be, you know, filled with the poison of hatred. He just hasn't. And I, you know, I think from a post-war survey that an interesting scholar did, I think a lot of Burundians feel as he did. Dale once said to me, you know, they were not themselves, meaning his countrymen, during this awful war. They were something else. And it's very interesting that this guy who was asking all the, these people in Burundi, you know, how they felt about this idea of truth and reconciliation, which is, some of those are truth and reconciliation commissions appear to have worked well in some places, but almost to a person, these people did not want one of those. And part of the reason was probably maybe some of them felt they had things they wanted didn't want to have come out. But the sense of the scholar, anyway, was that for many people felt that it would be unjust because people were killing or injuring others out of fear more than anything. And they were not themselves. What the people did say they wanted was to be able to talk to individuals, you know, on both sides. Although they did also say many of them, some of them anyway, that they wanted the people on the other side to apologize to them first. So
schoolyard mentalities exist in other.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The notion of truth and reconciliation, almost as if, you know, there is no truth. There just is the facts that occurred. And I do recall that part in the book in which Deo is talking about how he doesn't blame the Burundians for what occurred. He feels angry for what occurred, but he doesn't blame them. They were a different people, as you just said. I mean, it's an interesting observation. Without that sense of blaming, or without that sense of them and us, where does that come from in Deo?
Well, I think from his mother, in part. Uh-huh. An extraordinary woman, a real moral force, though she can neither read nor write. But I think also, and I'm sure it was there, you know, already. This contemplative spirit, you know, and openness to the possibilities of all the human beings around him. But where it managed to flourish again was at Columbia University. Dale went there. He did something very strange. To you know, seemed very strange. He majored in biochemistry, but he also took all the courses he could in philosophy, essentially a second major in philosophy. The least marketable skill you could possibly imagine. I mean, most immigrants would you know, not do that. They'd take something else. And I asked him why he did it, and he said, I wanted to understand what had happened to me. And of course, like all students of philosophy, he got more questions, not answers, as he himself put it to me. But he found this sort of mental space, the peace. And he would do this also in the great cathedral of St. John the Divine, which is right near Columbia, and also in the Riverside Church. Just go and sit there alone and think, and let his mind just be open to play across these landscapes, you know, of so pure thought. I think that philosophic, that's one of the reasons I used the quote.
Well, this draws me to the title of the book. I mean, it's this wonderful passage from Wordsworth.
Yeah.
And where did that come to you from?
I read in college. Wordsworth was one of the poets I studied in great detail. I always loved that poem. It comes from that stanza that has the line "Splendor in the grass" in it, which is what was turned into was used as a title for a pretty bad movie. But It goes on, you know. Will grieve not rather find strength in what remains behind, in the primal sympathy, which having been must ever be, in the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death and years that bring the philosophic mind. It's pretty good. Yeah, it's hard to, you know, I don't think you can parse it. I mean, I think most writers of narrative anyway, and certainly all poets, want to write something for which there is no exegesis that is as satisfactory as the piece of writing itself. You know, no exterior explanation that is a better explanation.
And I think this is the success of this book. I mean, it is curious to think about Wordsworth, because as a reader, your experience of this book is that you're opening it up, you're going through the title page, you're flipping the next page, and then you see the poem by Wordsworth, and you're thinking to yourself, how is Wordsworth going to provide some sort of commentary on this terrible turn of events in Burundi and Rwanda in some manner? After reading the book, you go back to that quote, and suddenly, you know, Wordsworth seems as contemporary and more relevant today than you ever imagined. That notion of the philosophic mind, I mean, that is Deo, and that is the sort of maturity that he earned himself, and that is his journey in this story.
You know, and the other part of his journey, which is really just beginning, you know, this is perhaps just all preface. I think I wrote these lines, something to this effect, that, you know, the questions that have been troubling him in Colombia, and the things that troubled him most about the world, there was an answer, or a partial answer, and it lay partly in his memory, because as a young man he had tried unsuccessfully, rather hilariously actually, to try to build a clinic for poor people in a town where he'd gone to school. But that notion that sometimes the answer lies in your hands, you have to do something. And so he did.
And it's that doing something that is interesting, because it helps, it provides a sort of commentary on that notion of forgetfulness and memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a way around both of them.
Because Deo in this book is so traumatized by memory. In the passages in New York City, I mean, you feel the post-traumatic shock of the events in Africa just crashing in upon him, where he gets into this cycle of the nightmares coming at night. He tries to stay awake and be an insomniac, so he doesn't have the nightmares. It makes him even more tired, makes it worse. It's really a painful process as a reader to follow him as he's trying to find some peace for himself after what he's experienced.
That he finds it, though. And, you know, the strength. I mean, I did write, and these are honest lines, that I, having heard this story, I knew I would not have survived. I'm sure I wouldn't have survived psychologically. Tremendous strength in this. And I think it, I mean, he didn't grow up in a spoiled way, privileged way. You know, he grew up with treks. It's a hard life, but with a loving family, he had those kinds of advantages that are so, you know, really fundamental. I don't know. I admire him, and I admire him the more, I suppose, for having not just survived all this, but to have surmounted it.
Where do we find Deo today?
I'm not at liberty to talk about that.
Okay.
And, he's fine, but I really don't. I'm keeping him out of this.
I understand. Where do we find you today?
In Los Angeles, but not for long. I'm in between books. I don't know what I'm doing next. I'm basically going around. I'm still talking about Mountains Beyond Mountains at colleges.
Yeah.
For some reason, a large number of colleges have inflicted that on their incoming students, you know, I've been going to a lot of them.
Such a terrible fate for those students.
Well, to hear some of them. One kid asked me, how do you feel about having your book be required reading? I knew what he meant, you know, because when I was in college, I acquired this assigned reading disability. I could read anything as long as it wasn't assigned.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much
for
this conversation. We're going to call it quits here. Usually we end with questions, but given Tracy's schedule, we're going to adjourn. You'll be able to buy copies of Strengthen What Remains, and talk to Tracy personally out in the lobby there. He'll sign books. And let me just also put in a brief plug here. This Aloud series is really a remarkable achievement of the Library Foundation and Louise Steinman and her staff. I feel very lucky to have been a part of this for a couple of years now, and I would encourage us all in one form or another to find some way to support this. It's my experience that you never know what you miss until it's gone, and I would hate to find the day that this is gone. So kudos to Aloud, to Louise, and also to Tracy.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.